If you want to hear about the opportunities that we are presenting to our investors, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club. We scour for the best opportunities and present those only to folks inside the club, and that is the only way you'll hear about our deals and what we're working on. We'd love for you to be a part. Again, go to BrickinInvestmentGroup.com and join the Brickin Investor Club.
It's interesting because it almost misses the part of housing that is unaffordable. What is unaffordable about housing is the cost of the land, not the structure. The structure isn't the problem. It's the land that is the problem.
Welcome to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate Show. Whether you are an active or passive investor, we'll teach you how to scale your real estate investing business into something big.
Ryan Smith graduated from the University of Tampa with a Bachelor's of Science in Computer Science. As an athlete, he was highly recruited for both baseball and basketball and was drafted as a senior in high school by the Baltimore Orioles and again in college by the Anaheim Angels. Ryan pursued his athletic talents by playing baseball throughout his college experience and now brings with him more than 15 years of extensive business experience. Ryan and his affiliates co-manage multiple investment funds which specialize in investing in mobile home communities and participates in the ownership and or management of over 20,000 mobile home community lots. Ryan, welcome to the show.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Hey, the pleasure's all mine. I mean, that's pretty impressive, first of all. How much fun was it to be in high school and then get, you know, drafted by who was that again? By the Baltimore Orioles?
Yeah, it was fun. It's fun to be recognized for gifts and abilities that, you know, sometimes it takes other people looking in and saying, hey, you're decent at this for you to realize it. So it was fun. I enjoyed my athletic career. It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, I bet. Man, that's awesome. I think that's every little kid's dream, at least in our generation, was to grow up and play professional baseball. Yeah. Maybe the sports have changed, but that's super cool. At what point in time did you decide that you were not going to be a professional athlete and then go into business?
You know, so I actually started my first company when I was around 13. So I was I look like a coder, like a complete nerd, and you don't have to confirm or deny that. But so I started coding when I was 8 and loved writing software. So anyway, started a software company when I was 13 and another one around 15 and had made quite a bit of money from this little software program it was actually an application I built for real estate investors to better analyze and forecast and model their investments. And I built it for my dad, who I thought needed it. And I ended up having about 140,000 customers globally of this little application I wrote. And so I was kind of a nerd on the mound. You know, I got to play baseball, throw hard, and I enjoyed the athletic side. But I also really liked the intellectual stimulation and the business pursuits. So when it came time to kind of choose which way I wanted to go, kind of brains versus brawn. Anyway, I thought I probably had a greater statistical chance at success using brains rather than brawn.
Right. One tends to outlast the other. You know, that's for sure. The body wears out before the brain wears out. So that's amazing. So what happened? And then I guess from the point of graduating college, then when did you get involved in real estate? And then how did you guys really get to where you are today?
Yeah, so real, real high level, I'll breeze through it. But if you have a question on any, just drill down. But for your sake, I'll treetop it. But so grew up in a real estate family, kind of as I indicated, in a way, scraping, digging, trenching, all the stuff young kids should do at a young age. I certainly did. Then I helped my dad. I kind of transitioned to more of the analyst in the family, recognized the need my dad had for tools, built the tool, the software application, ended up making quite a bit of money, probably $1 million, $2 million from that little software application, which was pretty unbelievable. And basically my wife and I parlayed that, you know, met my wife. She had an extensive real estate background on the property management side. So we came together, we had capital, we had awareness that real estate was a great place to play. We had a lot of the skill sets needed. You know, we had capital, we had analysis, we had management, we had this tool that I had built that, you know, investors could use. So anyway, we just kind of started from there, built a portfolio of about 25 single family houses. I was probably 23-ish. She was probably 21-ish. Realized pretty quickly that you couldn't scale. It was very difficult to scale in single family. And at that point, we were beyond our parents, and that's not to diminish them. Our parents are wonderful. We just were behind, we were beyond anybody we knew. And so, you know, you're kind of just trying to find a better path. And so we realized it wasn't that scalable, started looking for something that was more scalable. Basically, we ran an analysis on every product type we could think of. And our thought was we would run an analysis for storage, mobile home parks, billboards, apartments, the gamut, throw them all on the dining room table, let the models duke it out and pursue the ones that had the most merit based on our analysis. And the two that were the most compelling were storage and mobile home parks. And to make a real long, just to kind of fast forward, you know, we kind of went out, bought a mobile home park to the chagrin of our family. You know, we had no familial support. We had people who thought we would fail, and some maybe rooted for that. But, you know, we didn't. And we were right, directionally right, thankfully. And now almost, gosh, you know, 15 to 20 years later, the only two things we buy are storage and mobile home parks. And at this point, you know, we and all of our entities and affiliates, we've purchased more than 200 assets in about 30 states. So we've, you know, we still see, you know, I would say we still see as much opportunity in those two spaces today than we did back then. And we still find them as compelling today as we did back then.
That's awesome. First of all, I mean, you know, that you guys took the time to really analyze, and this comes, I guess, goes back to your analytical background, but to analyze all the asset classes and then settle on these two. And 20 years later, your thesis remains the same. That's a pretty compelling story. I know, at least for a lot of us, myself included in this, or maybe I'm just speaking about myself, our real estate journey tends to go like this all over the place where you know, you figure it out. You're like, okay, houses, okay, then notes, and okay, then this and that. And eventually you settle in on your track, but you figured it out early on. And I think it's interesting that you say in these two asset classes, because these are very hot asset classes right now, that you still see as much opportunity in this today as you did then. Can you talk about that some?
Yeah, the opportunity, I guess I'll say, you know, so Jamie and I have been in the business for as long as we have. And then we have a third partner now that we kind of joined up with many, many years ago. And he's been in the storage space specifically since 1970. So he's now been in it for 52 years. And at one point was the fifth largest owner of storage in the U.S. And so, you know, I'll also put words in his mouth, but he has said he's as enthusiastic about the business today as he has been in 52 years. But in short, you know, there's really no secret that there's opportunity in both spaces. I don't think anybody struggles to see the opportunity. It's the risks that people typically overlook, I think. And so they're not without their risks. And so we have to be cognizant of those. And part of that's location, you know, part of that's the quality of the asset, the layout of the asset, the financing, your leverage rate. You know, there's a lot of things you consider, but the potential in both asset classes we think are quite tremendous.
Right. Yeah, that's absolutely fascinating. I think one of the things, you know, kind of a hot button topic right now is the affordable housing space, right? And so I think in the mobile home community, you guys are meeting that. What are some things maybe that you guys are looking at kind of coming down the pipe, if you will, that maybe you're going to think about doing differently as it pertains to creating more affordable housing?
Yeah, no, it's a good question. So we don't really do anything on the development side from mobile home parks or manufactured housing communities. And it's kind of circular. The reason we don't, and is because it's very difficult to, which is, again, why we like the space, because the space is a fairly, what we consider a moated space or high barriers to entry. Very difficult to build a new mobile home park. There's about 55,000 of them in the United States. In any given year, about 10 are built or developed out of the ground, and about 150 are torn down for highest and best use of the land. So wow. That was, and by the way, that's dating back to why we got into the space, that was, you know, generally true back then. So it's very difficult to develop. There are high barriers, and those barriers are kind of left brain, right brain. The population around, who live around the proposed site for mobile home park, generally don't want a new mobile home park in their community for negative perceptions that are often not well founded. But, you know, there's crime and all this, you know, all this stuff, which is not, like I said, well founded, but there's a negative perception, a stigma. But then on kind of the left brain side, the municipal level, mobile home parks aren't known for generating high amounts of tax revenue per the acreage or square footage. So it's not an efficient use of land for tax revenue. So pretty much everybody agrees, you know, mobile home parks are not optimal for their community. Although everybody likes the thought of them, nobody likes them in their community. So the general thought is, yeah, that's great. Somebody's doing it, just do it somewhere else. And they're thinking the same thing there, wherever that somewhere else is. So we're not developing or building new ones. We're buying existing, and then we're operating them in a way that, you know, we believe provides an exceptional level of service, the quality of the experience. Anybody can go on our website and view kind of the flyover videos of what we own, and you'd probably fall out of your chair when you look at what we own as a mobile home park, because it's not anything like what you think. They're incredibly nice.
How do you guys provide an incredibly nice experience for your tenants and yet keep the cost of living low?
Yeah, it's a good question. So first, I would say it's tenant of what? Meaning when you say, you know, the tenants are, you know, as we think of them, are residents. There's two models within the mobile home park world. You could, you know, and I'll get to the point of what we own. And there's two ways to operate. One is you own all the homes and you rent the homes out and the land. Sure. That is not the model we prefer. We used to do that. We don't do that anymore. So most of our communities, we own none of the homes. So the residents own their own home and they pay for the land. And to your question, how does that contribute to affordability? Well, today you see a lot of new 3D printed homes. You see containers, you see tiny, you see all of these creative and the attempts at innovation around bringing down the cost of building a structure, right? But it's interesting because it almost misses the part of housing that is unaffordable. What is unaffordable about housing is the cost of the land, not the structure. The structure isn't the problem. It's the land that is the problem. So manufactured housing really solves for that in a unique way by bifurcating ownership of structure. You own your home, and ownership of land, you lease the land. So it removes the cost today to buy the land and you pay for it incrementally over time. So, you know, so when you look at a lot of the mobile home parks, at least that we own, you know, we own in really well-located areas. So for example, we have a big mobile home park just outside of Washington, D.C. We like the Washington, D.C. Metro. And that park generally, you know, rents are around $650 a month for the dirt. So you own your own home, three bedroom, two bath, call it 1200 square feet plus or minus, your 650 plus utilities, you know, within a 45 minute drive of Annapolis, Baltimore, DC, Alexandria. I mean, you're well located. Other locations nationally might be in the $300 to $400 range for the same, depending on location. But the reason it's affordability is the cost of the land is not included.
Right, right. No, that's a great point. What about companies? I mean, you know, who Warren Buffett, I think he owns Clayton Homes, or at least a large share of it. Where are all of those homes going if municipalities aren't building, you know, new mobile home park or new mobile home or, you know, manufactured home communities? Where are all those shipments going?
Yeah, so two things. So one, Berkshire Hathaway did buy Clayton, I think in 2002. I think they own all of it. And Clayton has done, when you think of mobile homes, you think of, I'm not saying you do, but the general consensus is low quality kind of crap. I think most people would be amazed if they walked through a new mobile home today, the quality of it. And so interestingly enough, Clayton's actually branching out and they're starting to actually build kind of stick-built homes using their pre-manufactured process. And a lot of home builders, I have a lot of good friends in Orlando that are pretty sizable home builders, and they all look to Clayton as the leader in their space, not just mobile homes, but general construction from a quality controlled standpoint. So Clayton has, I think, a lot of potential beyond just the mobile home park industry. But to answer your question, so there's a lot of mobile home parks, though not a lot of them are being developed, but their shipments are rising, right? Because what's happening is demand for mobile homes are through the roof. I mean, we, for the most part, you have somebody who wants to buy it before it hits your lot. So what we do, for example, in a lot of our parks, we've bought quite a few homes in the last year and sold them. What we're doing is we may buy a park that has, let's say, 20 vacant pads in the park. So it may have, you know, 200 occupied pads where all the residents own their home, but 20 vacant pads. So what we and a lot of people are doing is they're filling their vacancies. So they're bringing in homes, setting them up on the empty pads to then sell and, you know, get to full occupancy. And a lot of those parks that we've been doing that at are, you know, 96, 98, 99, 100% occupied, which is also, this is somewhat nerdy, but, you know, it's another nuance to mobile home parks where you actually have a potential occupancy of 100%, whereas with apartments, the theoretical max is 95%. You know, you always kind of model 95% occupancy because that other five is, you're really never going to hit. With mobile home parks, you actually can hit 100.
Yeah, now that's fascinating. Yeah, you're absolutely right. Because once your tenants are in and once they've signed a lease, I mean, where are they going? It's the cost of moving a mobile home would far outweigh any, even if you bump rents $50 a month. I mean, golly, it's going to take you years and years to catch up with that, you know, additional cost to move the house. So That's fascinating. Let's talk storage for a little bit, or briefly. I guess we're running short on time, but talk storage, you know, just how you guys got into that and, you know, what that industry looks like for you guys. I mean, I know you said you partnered with somebody who at one point was, what you said, the fifth largest owner in the country.
Yep.
What does that industry look like for you, and why is that a compelling asset class?
So we like storage for a lot of reasons. So kind of high points, and then I'll talk about why together, just real briefly, why mobile home parks and storage together. But in kind of general terms, in the 90s, the average, the demand per person in a market was around 3 feet per person. So a population, you know, your town, whatever, you know, so Memphis, total population times 3 square feet per person, that was kind of the demand. Today, it's almost 9. You know, when it was 3, everybody said it's never going to be 4. When it was 4, it's never going to be 5. Now it's 9. And the projection is that it could be 12 by 2030, 12 feet per person. So when you have populations in certain locations where you have growth in populations, people are moving there, you have a property in a very moated area where you can't develop new storage. So you have you have barriers to entry, and then you have adoption and utilization growing. All of those are really positive pressures on the demand side. And if supply is constrained by a moat, that's good for price pressure. But kind of some macro trends is you have, you know, baby boomers, you know, moving from big to small. That's, you know, that favors storage. Interestingly enough, about 10% of Americans use storage. 1 in 10 Americans are current users of storage. But when you look at millennials, there's data that suggests 30% of millennials are active users of storage. And they use storage actively, which is different. They use it as a spare garage or as their only garage, as a tool to save money on the apartment side. So anyway, there's positive trends in terms of utilization, you know, in adoption. You know, then you look at COVID more recently, where most people had to school their kids in their home. So that spare bedroom is now a schoolhouse. So the bedroom you store all your treasures in is now a schoolhouse. So then that moved to the garage, but then you needed to build a workout, a gym, because you couldn't go to a gym. And so now that stuff. So COVID has really, you know, demanded more out of our homes, which has created, you know, a nice tailwind for storage. So in the short run and long run, we're bullish on storage. The negative people will mention is supply, people building them everywhere. Anybody who lives anywhere has probably seen a new one pop up. So we're really picky on where we buy. We want to either build or buy where it's very difficult to build, you know, and I can give many examples to that. But the number one diligence item on both mobile home parks and storage is the asset moated? Is that location, is there a moat around that location? Is there something special about it? That's the number one question we ask. Now, why, I guess, real quickly on why both together, they are similar to manage, surprisingly. So from we have one management apparatus that manages both asset classes, but they're different in ways that are complementary. And this really speaks to net operating income, NOI. So obviously, for the most part, everything we do evolves and revolves around NOI, net operating income, and the value of a dollar, right? So the two best performing asset classes over the last 20 years for NOI growth has been manufactured housing, number one, self-storage, number two, and then apartments, multifamily, third. So we like that, and we think there's a good chance that it'll continue, although there's no guarantee that it will. We think it will. But when you look at the growth rates and how they've grown differently. So mobile home parks have taken a very consistent, its rise over run is very narrow and variant. So it has historically been more predictable and steady eddy as far as compared with storage. Storage has been a little bit more elastic in that when it runs, it really runs. So we like, to be succinct, we like the stability that manufactured housing provides a portfolio, but we also like the elasticity that self-storage provides a portfolio. For example, just quickly, last year, if you were to pick an asset class you would have wanted to own through COVID, our mobile home parks did incredibly well. So did storage. But mobile home parks grew a little bit more than storage. But if you look at the first 4 months of this year, storage has gone, I mean, I don't even want to mention numbers because it's staggering. But storage has gone up and to the right, and manufactured housing has kind of continued to plod along. So we like both of those, the stability of one and the elasticity of the other.
Right, right. Yeah, that I'm sure gives some risk-adjusted returns that, you know, you just can't produce each one independent of its own. You just couldn't produce that. So that's fantastic. Ryan, I've thoroughly enjoyed this. I'd love to learn about your business and what you guys are doing. You should be proud of what you guys have accomplished thus far. I look forward to seeing where you guys go in the next 15 years. This has been tons of fun. Let's jump here into the final four if we can. The first question is this: what is one piece of advice you would give to an aspiring investor?
Ooh, gosh, believe in yourself. But more than that, always, I mean, stick to your morals, like always do what's right, not what's easy. Sometimes what's right is easy. Sometimes it's hard, but always do what's right.
Right. Oh, that's great. That's a great one. When it comes to investing in yourself, what is one thing you're doing to stay on top of your game?
I like being around people who disagree with me. So I like that has taught me, you know, I'm learning how to become more agreeably disagreeable in that process, which I think is a lost art in our culture.
You're right about that. You are right about that. Yeah. Hey man, that's good for you for putting that out there. Cause that is how you stay sharp and, you know, sometimes change your own opinions. So that's fantastic. Question number three is this: when it comes to investing in the world, what is one way you're making the world a better place?
Oh, starting with my neighbor. We're really big on, you know, on building a fabric of community. My wife and I are. So, you know, love your neighbor as yourself. So that starts with Mark, and that starts with my neighbor, Dave, who are my favorite people on earth. And if I serve them well and they're fine, then we can go talk about their neighbors and serve them well and then go talk about their neighbors. So I'm not so much about the big picture and broad vision. I'm just going to go serve my neighbors well and make sure they're good.
Right. No, man, that's great. I love that. Ryan, if our listeners want to get in touch with you, what is the best way to do that?
My email is ryan@elevationcg.com. And it's all published on our website in the flyover videos of the assets, which is elevationfund.com.
Wonderful. Ryan, thank you so much for your time today. I do appreciate it.
You bet. Thank you.
Hey, thanks for listening to the How to Scale Commercial Real Estate podcast. If you can do me a favor and subscribe and leave us a review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Podcasts, whatever platform it is you use to listen, if you can do that for us, that would be a fantastic help to the show. It helps us both attract new listeners as well as rank higher on those directories. So appreciate you listening. Thanks so much, and hope to catch you on the next episode.